Henry Mancini, please. It's Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening, this is John McMullen, John Mack the Sun, welcome you to the 246th episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. The recordings for the previous 245 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com under the Radio Show tab. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. So that's johnmack13.com. In addition to the previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily newsletter at my web home. The newsletter is a curation of 10 news articles from around the country and the world. Try it and subscribe. Only one email per day, and it's free. So once again, that's www.johnmack13.com. One announcement before going further. In Upper Westchester and Putnam area, writers and poets may wish to participate in some of the terrific writing groups around the Mayapak writers group, now in its 21st year under the coordination of Vinnie DeQuino, meets every Thursday night at 6:30 in the Mayapak Library on Route 6 in Mayapak, New York. From that group, in the 21 years, over 100 published works have come out. There are also two poetry workshops in the area. The first meeting on the second Wednesday of each month at 6:30 p.m. in the same Mayapak Library, and the second on the fourth Wednesday of the month at 6 p.m. in the John C. Hart Library in Treboke, New York. The next Mayapak Library meeting is this Wednesday, September 12th, and the Treboke meeting is Wednesday, September 26th. Additionally, October 15th is the Poets Night at the Mayapak Library. There'll be presentations from the members of the poetry workshop. Then there'll be an open mic to any poets in the area, and we're asking the public to come one, come all. People wishing more information may contact me at johnmack13@gmail.com. That's johnmack13@gmail.com. Now to this week's show. As mentioned, the 246th in the series, my guest is poet Reggie Mara, author of the recently published Killing America, Our United States of Ignorance, Fear, Bigotry, Violence, and Greed. Reggie was the featured poet at the August open mic night at the wonderful Hudson Valley Writers Center in Sleepy Hollow, New York. And I was fascinated not only by his poetry, but by the fact that he was arranging to send a copy of the book to every member of Congress, senators alike, each justice of the Supreme Court and the President of the United States. We will, of course, touch on this work and what he hopes to accomplish with the mailings on tonight's show. The listeners wishing to join Reggie and me on the air may do so by calling 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. I generally hold caller participation until near the end of my conversation with my guest. But let's get started. Welcome to the show, Reggie.
Thanks very much, John. It's my pleasure to be here.
Why don't you just start us off with the poem?
Sure. And this will be from the new book that you introduced, Killing America. So this is entitled Early Autumn Southwest Evening. The music stops. Young women holding hands, their tank tops, shorts, boots, long flowing brown hair, and the young man in a black tee, blue jeans, and boots to their right, capture a neon backlit summer American evening. They run, semi-crouched amid food and beverage containers strewn across the open space, while those behind them kneel, crawl, crouch, and cower along the fence, unsure where the shooter is and when the shooting will stop, if ever.
Wow, that hits you right at the beginning. Thank you very much for it.
You're welcome. Yeah.
When did you grow up? Didn't go to early school, really?
I'm sorry, say that again, John. I missed that.
Where did you grow up? Didn't go to early school.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, so I grew up in Yonkers. Grew up in Yonkers, New York. I was actually born. I lived for 6 months in Tarrytown, but I don't remember any of that, my first 6 months on the planet. Grew up in Yonkers. Attended public school number 22 in the Pier Park in Yonkers for 3 years, and then finished my elementary schooling and middle schooling at St. Anthony's, which was built while I was in kindergarten, first grade, and I finished at St. Anthony's right across the street from the public school.
Do you remember what your earliest aspirations were?
They were, I can tell you, my earliest, I used to love the bookmobile, which would come by, you know, the school, I guess it was once a week. And I loved two types of books. I loved books on snakes, and I loved books about firefighters. So when I was a really young kid, a single-digit kid, being a fireman seemed like a really good idea to me. Yeah. That obviously shifted over the years, but it was the first thing I remember wanting to do was be a firefighter.
How about your high school years? Where'd you go to high school, and did you write for a school paper or literary journal?
Yeah, actually, I went to Sacred Heart High School, also in Yonkers. Did not write for the school paper. Participated in some other activities, but wasn't. I always enjoyed writing, but wasn't actively involved in doing extracurricular writing while I was involved at Sacred Heart. So all of my writing was either private or, you know, assignments for school.
And what happened after high school?
I went to St. John's out in Jamaica, Queens, St. John's University for 4 years. And then I took a long time off after that, and I went and got my graduate degree, which was not until 1990. I got in English at Iona College in New Rochelle, New York, which I know is your alma mater.
Yes, it was. What did you major in college?
Undergraduate, my major was in marketing, and I attribute that, which was a fine major. I got some good friends and some good professors, but when I was 18, I was a good student that had no idea what I really wanted to study, and so I followed the advice of some good folks who told me that would be a good degree with which to get a job when I got out. It didn't quite turn out that way, but... It was, I think, good and well-intentioned advice at the time. Although if I could go back and do it over again, knowing what I know now, my undergraduate degree probably would have been in literature with a minor in philosophy or comparative religion. That's what I would love to have been mature enough to study when I was 18, but I didn't know that back then.
Well, I was just the opposite. I was a philosophy major for 2 years, and then I noticed that in the New York Times there weren't many jobs for philosophers, and I switched to something which had much more promise, make lots of money in English literature. I was very lucky that I got into technology for 50 years, and then I went back to writing. Did you write at all in college?
Not for college itself, but I actually began writing poetry for myself in high school. I was attracted to that, and I was attracted to it primarily because I'd love to say it was Shakespeare or Dickinson or Chaucer or Blake or somebody, but I heard Kris Kristofferson when I was 16 years old and read his bio, in magazines and things, and as a Rhodes Scholar and an Army Ranger, and he was just bigger than life to me. So Kristofferson's lyrics were what really motivated me in high school to want to write. So that was my first real.
A terrific writer and a terrific voice, and one of my poems is about Bobby McGee, and I point out that I wrote for all sorts of publications, and I did this, I did that, but more people have heard the song than have ever read anything that I wrote. Well, it was a very good song. he was terrific, and I really liked his voice too. He had that really deep voice, and really good, I thought.
And he's still touring right now. He's touring, and he'll be on the East Coast in the springtime. I don't know if he'll be. He's been.
I realize that he's still touring. I saw him years ago at Alice Tully Hall, and I also saw him at the old Westchester Premier Theater when he was married to Rita Coleridge. And
yep. You and I were probably there together because I saw him there as well. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. But a terrific voice, and he said that he owed so much to another favorite of mine, Johnny Cash. So it was very interesting. But you didn't try to publish anything. You were writing for yourself mainly, huh?
Yeah. I didn't know what I was getting myself into when I began to write. I actually took in the early 80s, I was like teaching high school and coaching basketball at Sacred Heart, and I actually took 2 years off to write what I was going to be the next great American novelist, and took 2 years off just to write and live off my savings. And I learned a lot about myself, the publishing industry, and my writing skills, and I never did publish anything in terms of novel-length fiction, and learned about what I was not good at, what I was good at, and where I should be putting my attention. So, yeah.
Now, did you go right into teaching after St. John's, or did you do something else?
Yeah, it's a great question. So what I actually did, my senior year at St. John's, I was offered the freshman basketball coaching job at Sacred Heart. At that time, the varsity coach was Jerry Houston, who was a teacher and a coach while I was in high school. And Jerry had played for, he was a co-captain of Joe Lapchick's last years at St. John's. He was co-captain.
And for LaSalle High School, and I played against him. He was not accepted in open ball. I played against him. He was not accepted into a college. And I was talking to him. He wanted to go to college. And I called this friend of mine that I own, a brother Walsh. And I said, playing against this great guy, and he'd really fit into the program. And I later sent other people to Iona, and he said that he already looked into it, and they said with his grades at LaSalle they couldn't touch him. And 4 years later, he's the captain of the St. John's team.
So where did you go to high school? I know I shouldn't be asking you questions, but you played against him at LaSalle. Where were you? Where were you attending?
No. I played against him in open ball. He played for some CYO team, and I played for Good Shepherd in Upper Manhattan. I really didn't come into my own until I played open ball and everything well after college. But I was very short, and I never had good coaching. Now I'm 6'3", but that all happened in the middle of college.
Okay.
But I played open ball around Wall Street, and in leagues to Westchester and everything. So he was the coach there, though, huh?
Yeah, Jerry was the coach there, and he coached there through from, I guess, from 1970 through 1980. This last year was the 1979-1980 season. Yeah. So, but he offered me the coaching job. I did 2 years of freshman, 3 years of JV, and then when he left, I was the varsity coach through 1988 at Sacred Heart. Yeah.
Terrific. Terrific. Well, yeah. my brother was the principal of the Palm Memorial when the fellow named Lou Alcindor played there.
Okay, sure. Yeah.
So they were good. So the now you probably remember that his son Kevin then led the nation in scoring when he was at West Point.
Oh, I saw a lot of Kevin's games throughout the 4 years. I saw almost every game his senior year at West Point. Yeah. That was as much fun as, I mean, Jerry is still a good friend of mine. I spoke with him the last time was probably a week and a half or 2 weeks ago. We just remained really great friends. He was a teacher and a mentor and just a great friend. But watching Kevin play for, you know, some years in Pearl River High School where he attended, but then the 4 years at Army was as much fun as I've ever had watching basketball games. He was a lot of fun to watch. Yeah.
I never did he ever do anything after the service? They ever play in Europe or did they ever play anyplace else?
He played with I know he toured with a group of I don't remember the details with some Army guys. He did get a, you know, he tried out in the NBA. He got a tryout and, you know, gave that his best shot. And I think if he were a couple inches taller, he might have had even a better shot. But Kevin could play. I mean, he had the ball on the string. He could, and the number of times when he was at West Point that he dropped the ball to the bottom of the net from beyond the 3-point line when they needed a point to win or tie at the end of the game. I don't know how many times he did it, but he did it a lot. So he was in the game. It was just a lot of fun watching Kevin play. And he's, you know, I haven't seen him in a couple of years, but his son was a 1,000-point scorer at Southern Connecticut State University. I think he graduated in 2016 or 2015.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah.
Yeah, so there's a legacy of Houston's, just, you know, not dropping the ball into the bottom of the net. So they're pretty good at it. Yeah.
Yeah, like, it's interesting. Some of the best shooters in the NBA, their fathers were big men. Stephen Curry's father, though he was a 3-point shooter, but Kelly Thompson's father was Michelle Thompson, who was 6'10" and played the inside. So, that's interesting. As we come off basketball, what about the break for the poem?
Just asking that question again. I just didn't get the last end of it. I apologize for that.
What about another poem?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, sure. So this next one is thematically similar to the first one, slightly different setting. It's entitled Sunny December, New England Morning. And again, it's from Killing America. The children walk across the sunlit parking lot, long late autumn shadows falling to their left. Most, as rehearsed, hold their hands on the shoulders of the child in front of them. Some cry, some look confused. Some have their heads down as two uniformed officers and two plain-clothed women guide them away from the building. The adults don't yet know the enormity of the day, and while the children know less, some are young enough to feel the grown-ups' discomfort amid this chaos of sirens, lights, shouting, and guns. Time will pass, and the Florida woman who believes the parking lot scene and all events of this day are a hoax will be charged with making death threats against a parent of one of the 20 first graders killed. Other survivors will be harassed by Americans who argue the event was staged to erode support for the Second Amendment. And the Connecticut man will be charged for allegedly phoning in a threat to the new Sandy Hook Elementary School, which replaced the school that was demolished after the massacre.
Yeah, and this is obviously it's a debate that still goes on, both about gun safety and about people still, even this Alex Jones talking about it being a a cooked up deal with the Obama administration, who wanted to cripple the NRA. It's unbelievable. You know, all of the news channels, they would have had to been in on it. All of the state officials, all of the parents who really didn't lose children. It's just, you know, how that anyone can believe such a conspiracy is just beyond me.
Yeah, there are places where we can agree to disagree, where reasonable people can disagree, but those types of accusations, just the level and the scope of the conspiracy. And the thing is, I, without mentioning his name, one of the parents of one of the young people who was killed at Sandy Hook was a student at Sacred Heart while I was there. And I spoke with him in 2016. And I can guarantee you that it wasn't a hoax. Not that you need, not that anybody needs my voice to corroborate that, but it definitely was not a hoax. So, yeah.
So if you had moved up the basketball chain to high school varsity coach, what took you off to another pathway?
Basically that I realized that there was some things I was interested in. Writing was one of them, but that wasn't the primary thing at the time I left coaching and teaching. But that I really, there was a bigger curriculum I was interested in, and I needed to kind of expand my horizons. I loved going back and teaching and coaching at my alma mater at Sacred Heart. The 13 years I spent there were great. But there were certain things I wanted to do with regard to, again, teaching a larger curriculum that engaged the whole human being outside of the specifics of whether it be public school or Catholic school curriculum, that I really couldn't do while I was working for someone else. So I needed to move beyond that a bit.
Yeah, you've been involved with many things other than your writing, and it seems that much of your life has been focused on self-development, getting to know yourself and expanding your own talents. Number one, is it accurate, and would you take us through this path before we get into your writing?
Yeah, sure. No, it's thank you for that, Sean. It's very accurate. The 25 words or less backstory is I was a very good student, but I was also a very obedient kid, and so I basically did what I was told when I was in grade school and high school, whether it was by my parents or teachers. And I didn't know how to challenge authority at all. And I was paying attention. And as I got, you know, a little bit older, I started to realize that a lot of the people who were in authority didn't necessarily know what they were talking about. So I began to just study on my own. And most of my friends did that in adolescence, you know, do the adolescent rebellion thing. And I really didn't do it then. But I began to explore the interface of psychology and spirituality. I read scriptures beyond Catholic, you know, I was raised a Catholic. I read a lot of Buddhism. Some Hindu stuff. I read, you know, through just the Bible. I have some familiarity with the, you know, with the Jewish scripture. But I read across different religions, and I read a lot of psychology, and you know, a lot of theologies, anthropology, sociology, and just wanted to understand the bigger picture, both my experience of it and how my experience of it was very different from other people's. Experience that I knew, so I was fortunate enough to be very curious, is how I would describe that. So it was mostly, you know, after the master's degree at Iona in English, it was all self-taught. I mean, I just read everything I could get my hands on, and did some trainings after that, but not academic trainings.
Brad, you also in some way you were involved in programs at Maryland and online on telephone with the Canadian group. How did you make all these contacts, and how did you keep moving around?
Okay, so I'm gonna do the Canadian connection first. So somewhere around 1996, I saw a book entitled A Brief History of Everything, which was by Ken Wilber.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. Okay.
Yeah, so I read that, and I was intrigued by it, and I went and read the book that was based on, which is an 800-page entitled Sex, Ecology, Spirituality. And Wilber is arguably, in my estimation, the greatest living American philosopher, who was just integrating the canon of human knowledge. So I read everything he wrote, and I went to conferences that involved his work. And when I thought it would be a good idea, because I was working with a lot of individuals, to actually get trained as a coach, as a professional coach, not an athletic coach, I just looked around, and Wilber had actually endorsed the coaching program up at Integral Coaching Canada, which is in Ottawa, they've built this beautiful coaching technology or methodology, and it's grounded in some of Wilber's work and in some of Robert Keegan's work, who's a developmental psychologist, educational psychologist at Harvard. So I knew both of those individuals through their work. This coaching program was rigorous. It was grounded in models that I believed in. So I went and spent 2 years and a good deal of money getting trained by the folks up in Integral Coaching Canada. That was fairly recent. That was in 2009 to 2011. That's a fairly recent chapter in my life. The MUIH, the Maryland University of Integrative Health, is just one of my colleagues who is also an integral coach, and Joel Kreisberg is out in Berkeley, California. He's a homeopath and a chiropractor and integral coach, and I taught with him and a couple of other colleagues at Maryland University of Integrative Health at his invitation. He needed some people to join him as mentors for the students. So we did that for a few years, and then Joel actually built his own health coaching school out in Berkeley, and I still do some work for him out there. It's called Teleosis Institute. But all of that is tied in with the integral model, which, again, is Ken Wilber's primary work, and then integral coaching, per se, was actually Laura Devine and Joanne Hunt were the founders of Integral Coaching Canada up in Ottawa. And I actually work for them now too. I do some phone coaching for them.
And you've also kept up your athletic thing through strength training and through yoga. Now, is that tied in to the same thing, or is this an additional thing that you do?
Yeah, so just staying fit is important to me. So I was a fairly competitive. The thing I did best athletically, I would like to say it was basketball, but it definitely wasn't. I was a pretty good middle and long distance runner. Didn't do it for school, but ran 10K and 5K and mile races in my 20s and 30s. And then I had, due to some bad choices from when I was an adolescent, I had both my hips replaced in 2003. And I was pretty fit when I had that done, but I was only 49 years old. So I was committed to finding ways to stay fit. Even though I couldn't run anymore. I could have run, but it wouldn't have been a good idea with the titanium and ceramic prosthesis in both sides of my hips there. I use a Nordic Track machine. I do a lot of walking in the woods. I lift free weights. And I do five or six days a week, I do something. So I'm only about 5 pounds heavier than I was when I was racing in my 20s, which I'm happy about that. So. It just makes me feel good. It keeps my brain working. It keeps me alert, and I just feel good in my body. So it's completely selfish on my part, but I'm happy I'm doing it.
That's great. I've got, from basketball, I've got an ankle that will never work right, and I always have a brace on, and I've got arthritic hips, and I've got knees that I take things in, so my career ended long ago, and I can't do the kind of things that I want to because I can't walk properly all the time, It's annoying. Then back to your writing. Your first book was published in 1991, but you didn't publish poetry until 10 years later. What was the first book? And if you had been writing poetry for yourself, why didn't you have poetry either before or after the first book?
Yeah, no, thank you for that question. So yeah, I had been writing, and I actually began reading my poetry at readings when I'm somewhere in my mid-30s. I began doing that. I wasn't doing it when I was in my 20s. And I did that because I liked the poets I was meeting. I liked, I loved writing poetry. But the first book I wrote, which was entitled The Quality of Effort, that came out in 1991. And the subtitle was Integrity in Sport and Life for Student Athletes, Parents, and Coaches. And it was really based on my own experiences as a student athlete, where I primarily got cut from just about every basketball team I tried out for. And then I ended up coaching for 13 years. I was really working with the disparity of my own experience and some other kids, you know, some of my student athletes, some of whom worked really hard and were just pretty good at it, some of whom didn't work so hard but were really gifted. And so the phrase, the quality of effort, occurred to me. And I'll have to just tie a name in with that. One of my student athletes who graduated in the mid-1980s, Edwin Knoll. Ed is down in, I believe he's in Georgia now. But in working with him at one point, the phrase, the quality of effort, came up. So I entitled the book The Quality of Effort. I wrote a book that I thought was a sane approach to youth, scholastic, and intercollegiate sports, based on my own experiences. I wasn't one of the successful athletes. I was one of the guys who really wanted a uniform and wanted to be on a team and got cut. And so when I had to cut kids from my basketball team, make the choices, if I had 13 uniforms and 45 people trying out, I tended to be really present, or I did my best to be really present to how I let the guys who weren't going to make the team know about that, which is what Jerry Houston taught me. And he passed some really good, lessons on that. Anybody comes out for your team and they're not going to have a spot, you thank them. And you explain to them why they don't have a spot. But you really, you do it in a very, very personal and a very, very in-person way. You don't just post a list on a locker room door somewhere. So I got to credit Jerry with teaching me that. And my own experience helped, because getting cut was more fun.
At the risk of alienating people who may not agree with me, that is the lesson that he should have taught the president of the United States. I have had through my career as an executive in technology, have had to fire people, and that's a difficult thing. But you have to look them in the eye and you have to tell them why they're being let go, and you have to, what they might do better elsewhere and what the problems are. But you don't fire them by email or by tweet or by having someone else do it. And I think that's one of the big personal lackings in the administration, that you can't be a coward doing difficult things. But that's only my belief. So.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's a level of cowardice there. I agree with you. So, yeah, I agree with that for sure.
Your next book, The Living Poems, Writing Lives, dealt with poetry, but was not poetry itself. Tell us about that book.
Yeah, so what I did was took poetic tools, literary tools, really, everything from metaphor to texture to imagery to diction. I rounded up about 13 of them, point of view or perspective. And I wrote it was really a very, very basic primer in terms of applying those tools to writing a poem. But the book, I think, had value in that the second half of each chapter took that tool and applied it to living a conscious life. So how would you use a metaphor? How do you use metaphor in living your life? How do you use imagery in living your life? How would you use the idea of theme or texture in living your life? And I unpacked each of those literary tools, again, both as something you could use when you write, but also something you incorporate into how you lived your life and became increasingly self-aware. That book was, I appreciate your mentioning, it's an incredibly well-kept secret. yeah. But actually,
one
that
title.
Came out in two, go ahead, I'm sorry. Yeah.
No, go ahead.
So that actually came out in 2004. The first book of poems, which was entitled Who Lives Better Than We Do, came out in 2001. That was the first time I came out with a book of poems, which was actually 2001.
One title that really caught my eye was your third book of poetry, and now still Grave and Goofy Poems. Please tell us about that book.
Yeah, so And Now Still, which came out in 2016, Grave and Goofy Poems, is really my personal exploration of loss. My dad died in 1996 on Valentine's Day, and he died at the age of 88, so he had a good life. He was a World War II vet. He was a plumber. He's a good guy, but his last 2 years were tough. After that, I went back and took care of my mom for 3.5 years, and she passed in 1999. And then my sister, who was a year older, died unexpectedly in 2009. So what And Now Still, Grave and Goofy Poems did was capture my experience of their respective lives and deaths. It's fairly, I won't say graphic, but very direct in terms of dealing with how each of them died. And my experience of losing, you know, my parents, which is kind of in the normal course of things. Again, they died at 88 and 83, respectively. And then my sister died at the age of 55. So it was part of it was my own processing the grief and watching myself grieve their losses. And then the last third of the book is about moving forward. It's more about, okay, what do you do when you suffer a loss? What are some of the things you might be able to look at that'll help you move forward. So first two thirds are about their deaths and dyings. And then the last third is a little bit more about how you move on. A lot of people call me on the cover of the book because it actually is of their grave marker. And there are three rectangles with their names and their dates of birth and death. And then there's a fourth rectangle that's blank, which is the space, you know, where my name would go at some point. So it's a fairly stark reminder of the inevitable, which is fine. Yeah, nobody given enough time doesn't die. So we're all in this together.
Yeah, we have one of those. My grandfather bought a plot in Gate of Heaven for six people. He and his wife and my father and my mother are buried there, and his Barbara and I are the two that are left to go up on the thing. Yeah. From 1997 through 2004, during the open mic nights, one of my favorite places, where I met you, at the Hudson Valley Writer Center. How did you get involved there, and why did you stop?
Yeah, so I got involved because I read something in what was, at the time, I think, used to be called the Herald Statesman. Now I think it's a Journal News, but it was the local Yonkers paper. And they announced that the Hudson Valley Writer Center had purchased the old Sleepy Hollow train station. It might have been called North Tarrytown train station back then. And they
Biloxi Manor train station.
So anyway, they had purchased that, and they're having their first open mic there, and I believe it was November of 1996. I may be making that date up, but it was sometime in late 96. So I went up. There are a bunch of people there, and I got to know the executive director and the assistant director, and I went every month, and it was sometime in the summer of 97, and I had been speaking with, I got to know them pretty well, and they said, they were doing everything themselves. And they said, we need to go on vacation, but we don't want to cancel the open mic. Would you mind hosting it? Because they knew I'd been a teacher and I could stand up in front of a group of people and make believe I knew what I was doing. So I said, sure. So I went and I hosted it, and then it went well. Nobody got hurt. And when they came back, they said, we really need to delegate a lot of these things we're doing. Would you like to do it regularly? And I had loved doing it. So I said, yeah. So I began doing it regularly sometime in the middle of 1997. I got married and moved to Connecticut in 2000, did it for another 4 years, but I was about an hour and 15 minutes away, and to get down there, open up the building, set up the snacks, do the open mic, And we used to, there was no limit. So we, you could, it was 5-minute limit, but if we had 35 people sign up, they all read. It ended up being an 8-hour gig. And I just, after a while, I just, it was just, I couldn't afford the, all the time, the commute down, the whole time there, and the commute back up to Connecticut. So I basically gave them like a 3-month notice and said I wasn't going to do it anymore. But I loved doing that. I had, you know, we had a regular group of people, and for 7 years, and we had big crowds, and we just had fun. It was a safe place to read. Nobody got censored. It was just a lot of fun for me to do, but it was primarily mileage, and I'm getting older, where I just couldn't really afford to. If I was still living nearby, I might have still continued doing it, but it ended up being an 8-hour gig with the commute round trip. So it got to be too much.
You mentioned you've been living in Connecticut. Did you ever go to any of the open mics that Curly's done in Stamford?
Yeah, in fact, I know Ralph, Ralph Nazareth. I was in 2012. I was a co-feature at Curly's down there in Stamford, and. I don't know how long that's been going on. I know it's been going on for quite some time. And another place I went to on a regular basis, which is no longer running, but was called the Wednesday Night Poetry Series. It was a weekly gathering in Bethel, Connecticut, which I started going to in 96 when I was still living in New York. And I did that. There was some great folks there as well. I went to that for about 10 years. Connecticut was... a really good place for me as well. I met a lot of fine folks up here.
Yeah, Ralph's been on my radio show, and I was the featured poet there last, I guess it was maybe even in the springtime. But okay. I've been there. But once again, it's a trip for me, and during the winter when it's dark and I have no idea where I'm going around Stamford, it's a little more difficult, you know. So, in 2016, you co-authored the book on coaching and healing. Please tell us both about the subject and the book.
Yeah, so you mentioned earlier that I did some work in Maryland University of Integrative Health with my colleague Joel Kreisberg. And through that work, Joel and I did some other work together through Teleosis Institute, which is his own not-for-profit. But we got together with 8 other people who had gone through the same coach training that we had gone through up in Integral Coaching Canada. And we committed to meeting once a month online through Zoom technology, because we had people in Canada and all over the U.S., to explore how coaching could be used in the healing process. Healing in the broadest sense of that word, both physical healing, but emotional healing due to illness or loss or whatever. So we met together for 2 or 3 years and wrote a paper together, and we realized we had enough raw material for a book, and we got published by a group called Integral Publishers, which is out in Tucson, Arizona, and the book came out in 2016, and it essentially is an application of the Integral Coaching methodology to a healing topic, so how you can use the type of coaching we were trained in to help somebody heal from loss or injury or illness. And again, we're not speaking about magic physical healing, but about the emotional, psychological suffering and pain that we often go through, which with good coaching can be alleviated, if not entirely eliminated. That actually was a great project, because if you had told me 30 years ago that 10 people could write a book together, I would have laughed at that prospect. But there was 9 remarkable folks that I got to work with. And interestingly, we all had some aspect of healing in our own lives to work with. 2 of them have since passed to cancer. One woman, Jill Lang Ward, one of the authors, never saw the book in print. She died in May of 2016, just before the book came out. And so it was a really intense bit of work together, because a bunch of the folks who were authors were really struggling with their own health and their own illnesses while we were working together. So it was pretty. It was a great awareness builder for me.
It sounded like it's pretty intense too during that time. Yeah. Can we break for another poem?
Sure. What I'd like to, this next one, it's actually in the new book, Killing America, but it was first published in the book you mentioned, And Now Still. And I wrote it for my sister, but it's really relevant, my sister Anne Marie, who again passed in 2009. But it fits into the theme of Killing America as well, both in terms of its literal title and in what it does, what I hope it does in between the lines. So it's entitled The Sniper. The sniper breathes deep, slow, squints through the scope, truth in the crosshairs, the solution, precisely committed to freeing the hostage. Last resort, attainable horizon, not a solution, but the solution. When negotiation or hard work fails or takes too long. If only it were that easy, held hostage as we are, bliss and rage, reason and myth, memory, all of them, always them, without which we might see clearly, find freedom. Who is the sniper for the pain that holds you hostage? What does she see or not through her narrow scope as she squeezes the trigger? Another option, perhaps, just outside her field of view, a hair away from your final solution. We all play each role, taker, hostage, sniper, moment to moment, holding, held, setting free, problem and solution. We love the scope, the crosshairs promise, at times too slow or quick to squeeze the trigger, release, the solution's allure and terror.
Yeah. Yeah. And now, speaking of that, to your current project, your brand new book of poetry, Killing America, Our United States of Ignorance, Fear, Bigotry, Violence, and Greed. Please tell us first about your reason for writing the book, and then explain the content.
Yeah. So in 2006, I published a small book entitled This Open Eye, Seeing What We Do. It was based on images out of the Iraq War, about our attack on the country of Iraq in 2003. The images were both of U.S. military personnel and of Iraqi civilians, you know, the impact of the war on them. So that was a preface for the new book. About 2 years ago, as we had increasing numbers of school shootings and concert shootings and nightclub shootings and just shootings in general in this country, I began to focus more on how we're killing each other. You know, we don't need war. We just walk in the streets and in suburbs of the cities of America, you can get shot. And I began focusing on gun violence, but then I stepped back and tried to take a larger view at what I would describe as an underlying culture of the normalization of violence, both physical violence, gun violence being one example of that, but I think emotional, I would say financial, other types of violence where power and money are really used in ways that do great harm and not good to people, whether we're talking about healthcare or literal violence on the street, or what we ask young men and women in the military to do, because some of our wars have been questionable at best. Some of the use of the military has been questionable at best. So it became a bigger picture for me than just the gun violence issue. So what I've tried to capture in the book were both images from what happens in war and what happens on the streets of America, and then some commentary as well on the role of finance and the profit motive in drug addiction and rehab, and just some of the larger, more metaphorical types of violence that many Americans suffer under. So that's what I was aiming for there, was the bigger picture. It includes gun violence, and it addresses that, but it's not just about that.
So I have the book, and it's extremely powerful, and it's extremely well done. You then took the unusual step of setting up the GoFundMe site to raise the necessary funds to send copies of the book to every member of Congress, each Supreme Court justice, and even the president. And you also included copies of your cover letters to recipients in the book. What was behind this move?
I was just saying, you use the tools and use the talents that you have. I try to use the tools and talents I have. So I have no illusions or delusions that sending a copy of the book, which we did, we mailed them on September 4th, they should be arriving, sent them media mail, so they'll probably get there, you know, sometime tomorrow or Tuesday, we hope. I have no illusions that it's going to change anybody's mind or make a difference in the hearts and minds of some of our elected officials. They already have Springsteen's work. They have Christofferson's work. They have Naomi Shihab Nye. They have Billy Collins. They have a lot of poets who are bigger than I am out there who have written stuff, and we have singer-songwriters who have performed stuff. It doesn't make any difference sometimes. But it was something that I could do, and if one senator or one congressman or one Supreme Court justice actually took a look at it and could understand the underlying message of the book, which is really bipartisan, let me rephrase that, it's not bipartisan, it attempts to be transpartisan. And right now, the Republican Party happens to have all the power in Washington, D.C. That's just true. They have the White House, they have the Senate, and they have Congress. And in one way or another, they kind of have the Supreme Court, too, or they will. But if the Democrats were in power, they would be getting the same focus from me. And so the important thing I wanted to convey was, if you're only protesting against unarmed black men being shot, and you should protest that. Or if you only care when a cop gets ambushed, and you should protest that. Or if you only care when innocent concert goers or dancers get shot, or first graders. All those things should be disturbing, but they're kind of normalized. So my goal in this country, they seem to be normalized, in putting this book together, and it's just 104 pages of poetry. I mean, with the notes, it's about 130. It's a convenient place if you really care and you're an elected official. You can see great examples from 1993 to 2018. I had to limit it because if I went any further, there'd be too much. I had to stay away from the Vietnam War. You can really get a look at the violence in our culture, and that should be disturbing. If you're normalized to that and it's just the way things are, or people who say it's the cost of freedom, there are lots of free countries that don't do what we do. So I just figured, here's some poetry. If a handful of elected officials actually ever see the book, a staffer is going to open it, maybe throw it in a drawer, or throw it away, who knows. But that's something I could do. And if it makes a difference a little bit, great. If not, I got to write some poetry that I care about.
You know that the president won't read the book. He doesn't read any books. But how many members of the administration that you sent it to do you think will actually read it?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't begin to guess. I mean, when you say administration, like Congress has sent all of them. Because the president and vice president are the only two people in his administration that got copies. I don't know. It depends on the staff. I have a funny feeling because I like my representatives here in Connecticut. I have a lot of respect for Chris Murphy, especially Richard Blumenthal. My particular congresswoman is not running for re-election, Elizabeth Esty, but Rosa DeLauro, who's down in New Haven County, they may read the book. I'm on the same page with them on most issues. So, and there's other people around the country. Barbara Lee out in the Berkeley district in California, Cory Booker in Jersey, Chuck Schumer in New York. I think some of them may look at it, but I don't know. I might get surprised. I wrote short notes to select senators and congressmen and women on the cover letter, because it's a typed cover letter. And they all got basically the same one. The senators got the same one. The reps got the same one. The president got a unique one. The justices all got the same one. But I wrote handwritten notes on a bunch of them, and including John McCain's. I always had respect for him. And when he finally passed, I had to go digging through the boxes of envelopes to find his copy. I opened it, took the cover letter out, printed a new one, and wrote a note to his staff instead, and just expressing paying my respects for his passing. So it wasn't just to one party or the other, but it was to people that I respected. And I didn't write one to everybody I respected, because it was a big project to begin with. It took a lot of time, and I'm grateful for all the people who sent me a few bucks so we could do the mailing. Writing poetry isn't a high-paying gig, so I have to make my living doing some other things.
I know that well. As a matter of fact, I'm the poet laureate of the town of Yorktown, and I read poetry at the town board meetings, among other things that I do. And at the town board meeting last week, I read the poem John Sidney McCain. It was about McCain, and it was it got a good response, even from people that are of different parties. Because the thing that struck me was when he came back from Vietnam and he moved in to be a legislator and in the Senate, he then joined forces with another Silver Star winner, John Kerry, of opposite party, who came back to oppose the war that McCain still supported, to normalize relationships with Vietnam. Then they went over there together, and he met his captors and his torturers, and he even embraced them. And my poem ends, I don't see how that he could do that. I know I couldn't. Could you? But it's something that I admire that he was able to do. I thought he was a straight shooter, I thought, So.
Yeah. I agree. So no, I can't imagine who might read the poems, but I hope, a handful of people, do crack the book open. That would be nice.
You mentioned Billy Collins. One of the coincidences was that you mentioned that one of my previous guests before the holiday, Sarah Bracy White, had hosted a poetry contest that Billy Collins judged and that you were the winner. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's actually, I appreciate you actually raising that, because that gave me some confidence. There, it's 1997, and it was the 26th or 27th annual Tana Greenberg Poetry Contest. It was open to New York State residents, and I was living in Yonkers. In fact, I was taking care of my mom at the time. My dad had died, and I was taking care of her. And they announced the winners live at a Sunday afternoon reading at the, I don't know if it was a town hall or some official building in town of Greenberg. So I said to my mom, I'm going to go for a ride. I said, there's going to be refreshments. I'm not going to win anything, but we'll get some lemonade and some cookies. So we went up there together. And we didn't know who the judge was at the time, because the judge's name wasn't announced until afterwards. So they announced the different categories, kids and then adolescents, and we got the adult one. And Sarah, whom was just this wonderful human being, I like Sarah a whole lot, announced the adult winner, and it was the poem was entitled 11:43 Saturday Night, and it was mine. I got to read it in front of some folks, and the icing on the cake was that, any judge I would have appreciated, but I already knew who Billy Collins was, and it was a couple of years later he became the Poet Laureate of the U.S. And I got to thank him in person. A couple of years later, I met up with him at the master school in Dobbs Ferry and actually thanked him for selecting the poem. And he was very gracious. But that was that gave me some confidence that maybe I had, you know, some level of poetry chops that I could, you know, do more good than harm. So it was an unexpected victory. Yeah.
That's the end of when Ed Randall, talking baseball on Saturday morning, he quotes Vinnie Scully ending his show as saying, "Well, I've done all the harm I could do for this session."
Sure. Yeah.
We have a caller from the 914 area code. Let me see if we can bring the caller on.
Sure.
Who do I have there from the 528 exchange? Caller from the 914 area code, 528 exchange. Are you with us? No response, or a shy person, I guess. So, what's next for you?
Right now the book project is, I'm not done with that. You know, the book just did come out, so I'm doing some promotional things. But I'm getting on a plane on Wednesday, and I'm going to do a reading and do a workshop out in Vancouver, Washington, which was actually scheduled. I committed to this a year and a half ago. I didn't know that the book was coming out at this point, exactly when. And so it's it's a good guy, Christopher Luna, who was the poet laureate. I forget the name of the county out there, but wherever Vancouver, Washington is in that county. And he and I are, actually, he's one of my first cousin's oldest kids. And he studied poetry at the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics at Naropa University in Colorado. And Chris is
very interesting.
He's a good guy. And so he said, if you can afford to get out here, we'd love to have you feature. So he gave me the choice of months. And I picked September for some reason. So I'll be, reading from the new book out there. And they have a great poetry program. It's over 10 years old, and they, on a regular basis put, anywhere from 30 to 50 people in the room per reading. So it's it'll be nice. So I'm going to do that, and then just keep promoting the book in small ways, and keep coaching folks, and keep writing.
We've covered a lot of bases tonight. What else would you like the audience to know about Reggie Mara?
I think it's important, arguably one of the more important things that I think I can do as a human being is to get know myself increasingly more deeply with each day of my life. I think I'll know myself close to completely when I take my last breath. But John, what you and I were speaking about, using John McCain as an example, and you mentioned, John Kerry, and I think he had a similar relationship with Joe Biden, not so much from the military standpoint, but from a political opponent, is that really learn to, I really believe that if we take the time to breathe, we can really learn to speak to each other when we disagree, and still disagree, but do it from a very respectful way, as McCain and Biden have done for years, and as Barack Obama did with a lot of people, that we don't have to, just because somebody's in a leadership position doesn't mean they're doing it right. The current president doesn't know how to lead, and he basically thinks insulting is the way to go. And I know for a fact that that's incorrect. And it is possible, if you recognize that each of us is human, albeit from different ethnicities, different nationalities, different upbringings, different life experiences, that if you recognize that common humanity and you're willing to really listen, there's virtually no disagreement that can't be resolved in peaceful ways. That's a hard lesson for a lot of people to learn, though, it seems. So I'd like people to know that that's possible and that I believe it's possible.
I believe that you're right, and I think it's inspiring. I don't think that we're going to see it in our lifetime, because we not only have to get over everything that we don't do well as a country, then we have to get over what we in the rest of the world don't do well together. But I think that you have to
work on it. I agree with you. Yeah, I agree with that 100%. It's not magic. it's hard work.
Yeah.
But I think it's definitely attainable.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure. And can you take us off with another poem?
Sure. I'm going to read, in fact, this is the last, the most recently written poem that's in the book. And it's actually inspired by Naomi Shihab Nye's poem, Kindness. And this is actually entitled, This Day, Our Daily Dead. It'll take me about 2 minutes to get through this, just so you know that, John. Is that okay?
That's fine.
Okay. So this is This Day, Our Daily Dead. We wonder and worry what it will take for our country women and men to feel again this tender gravity, this pull of and toward kindness, the way we did when we were very young children. We do not need our passports. We need not travel beyond our borders, giving ourselves this day our daily dead as we do. Rarely really seeing them, though, protected as we agree to be from the truth of what we do and who we are. 21st graders are not enough. Yet another unarmed black man or ambushed cop is not enough. Concert and moviegoers and dancers are not enough. A shopper, bus driver, and landscaper, still not enough. High school students, not enough. We don't know if it will ever be time to look at the images no one wants to see because they're too disturbing, unless they're broken or burned beyond recognition un-American bodies. But our relentless refusal to look deeply at what's disturbing is itself disturbing. Our terrified turning away from what is traps us ever more tightly in it, as if that ever-growing malignancy will on its own dissipate and disappear if we make believe it's not there, even though we feel its pressure within our hearts every moment. Peekaboo, it says, how much more of me do you need? How much bigger do I need to be before you admit I'm part of you, and you have the will to do what has to be done to remove me, before the lost voice of that vulnerable child within you is truly able to remember and say, all gone. How much more will you ever be enough?
That's the whole message that you and I were just talking about, all in that one poem.
Yeah. Yep. Thank you. Yeah, I think it is. I think I realized it as I was reading it, but I think it is. Thank you for saying that.
So, any comments or questions to me about the show to johnmack13@gmail.com, and be sure to join us next week at the same time. And in the words of Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, if the Mets win, put it in the book. And until next time, as used to say in the old neighborhood, see ya. And we'll go off with the person that I mentioned earlier. Amazon, play Man in Black.
Here's Man in Black from your library on Amazon Music.
Well, you wonder why I always dress in black, why you never see bright colors on my back, and why does my appearance seem to have a somber tone? Well, there's a reason for the things that I have on. I wear the black for the poor and the beaten down, living in the hopeless, hungry side of town. I wear it for the prisoner who has long paid for his crime, but is there because he's a victim of the time. I wear the black for those who've never read or listened to the words that Jesus said about the road to happiness through love and charity. Why, you think he's talking straight to you and me? Well, we're doing mighty fine, I do suppose, in our streak of lightning cars and fancy clothes. But just so we're reminded of the ones who are held back, up front there ought to be a man in black. I wear it for the sick and lonely old, ones whose bad thrift left them cold.
Well, goodbye. Good night, everyone. Thanks for listening.